Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, welcome to History Speaks. I am the host, Reverend Michael Rogers. I am the host of Gospel Gold, which comes on every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Gospel Gold is not just another music program. It is a program dedicated to the preservation of traditional African-American gospel music. I am not a DJ. Our program basically talks about the history of gospel music and the great contributions our people have made through the gospel recording industry. We look at the gospel artists. We look at the gospel recording labels. We also look at the various different styles of gospel. I'd like to direct you to the Gospel Gold Group's Facebook page. Go there. Don't forget to like and then share so others will know that Gospel Gold is on the air. There you will find the link each week for the Gospel Gold program. Gospel Gold new season will start February the 28th. February the 28th, Monday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can tune in right here at Blog Talk Radio, and you can be a part of the Gospel Gold program. But tonight, we're not talking about Gospel Gold tonight. Tonight, we are talking about Black history, and I call this segment History Speaks. I wanted to some people during this month, people who are well-versed in African-American studies and African-American history, people who have studied on their own, people who are part of the community who can share with us on a layman's terms exactly what Black history and why is it important for us to study Black history. Many of us are not as well-versed. We don't read like we should. We don't study like we should. And there are times in our lives when we need to know exactly who we are and where we're coming from. That way we can inspire ourselves to go forward. I thank God for the fact that when I was young, I was told to keep a journal. I think I was probably in about the seventh or eighth grade at that time. And ever since then, I have kept journals all my life. And one of the things that does is that you're able to look back and read some of the things that you have done in the past and some of the experiences that you have had in the past, it can inspire you to move forward. And I think that this is what we can do with our young people. We can start them that way, to be interested in history, to chronicle their history, to chronicle our history as a people. What will historians, what will people say about this generation? What will they say about us? How will we fit into the history of the African-American people and the people of, in general? How do we fit? What will be said about us? And I'm glad tonight that I have a man that's with us, Brother James Pugh. Brother Pugh is a speaker. He's a philosopher. He's a lifelong historian. He's also a regular contributor to the Black Reality Think Tank that can be heard every Tuesday night, 8 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Central, on the Time for Awakening program. But I've asked Brother Pugh to be with us tonight, and perhaps he will be able to enlighten us on a lot of things that we need to know as a people in order to grow, in order to become a people that can sustain themselves and can inspire the next generation to come along and do the same. So I'm glad to have Brother James Pugh. Brother Pugh, are you on the line tonight?
Yes, Reverend Rogers, I'm available. Yes.
Thank you so very much for being a part of this segment that we wanted to present in Black History Month. I call it History Speaks. So I'm going to go get right to it, Brother Pugh. What is it that inspired you as a child, as a young man growing up? What inspired you to learn more than what the school gave you? Because we all went to school. We all learned about Abraham Lincoln. We all learned about Thomas Jefferson. We all learned about George Washington and all that big history book that we toted every day. You know, we learned all that stuff. But that wasn't the whole story, was it?
No, it wasn't. In fact, just before I begin, though, I just really do want to express my appreciation for your concept. One of the problems that we've had is the fact that, you know, because we've been devalued, the assumption is that there's no wisdom in us as a people, but rather there's wisdom only in our selected leadership. And other people select our leaders, and as a result, we find ourselves adrift. So I just really appreciate the idea that you recognize that there's a wisdom in the people, if you'll take the time to seek it. I'd say that, you know, this George Floyd type experience is not new. This is something that, you know, has happened, you know, all of us can talk about, you know, egregious, insults that, you know, that we've witnessed or suffered ourselves and so on. And so one of the questions I asked when I was, I don't know, about 13 or 14 is that, well, it's clear to me that this isn't right. But the question is, how did this, you know, how did this start? And what can be done about this? You know, how is it that, you know, my people are in the situation that they're in? So that was the first question. But the second event, triggering event, was Bill Cosby did a film called Black History, Lost, Stolen, or Strayed. Now, I later found out that, I don't know, some of the audience will be familiar with 60 Minutes, and there was a commentator on 60 Minutes. He would do like about 5 minutes at the end, and he was kind of a curmudgeonly type fella. Well, he evidently is the one who wrote the words that Bill Cosby spoke. But what Bill Cosby said was that, you know, the history books are not complete. There's stuff in the history books that ain't true. There's stuff that's true that ain't in the book. And then the third experience that I had was that I had been used to talking to people in authority who either didn't know or didn't want to know or didn't want to tell me the whole story and so on. And so it just occurred to me that, well, you know, it seems to me that I'm going to have to take some responsibility here and try to understand it for myself. And so the final thing that I did that sort of made me who I was that I happened to be, I really hate the fact that I wasn't a reader when I was young. But one of the books that I did read was called Adventures of a Mathematician. And in that book, this fellow was, you know, he was, you know, one of the fellows who was involved in building the atomic bomb. And he was talking about the ability to model that he could tell you how many blades of grass were in a field, right? And I said, they can do that. And so it occurred to me that, you know, given this goal I have to try to understand why the world is the way it is, I combine that with this sort of physicist, mathematician way of looking at the world of saying, you mean to tell me you can model how many blades of grass there are? Well, then if you can do that, then you can certainly get an understanding for why the world is the way it is. And so that's what motivated me to sort of develop some robust models about how the world is and not simply be dependent upon degrees and credentials and, you know, and so on.
What part of the country did you grow up in?
My people are from Mississippi, Laurel, but I was raised in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and that's pretty much where I grew up. When I finally graduated, I graduated in engineering in '84. I went to Florida as an engineer. And then I actually married someone from Louisiana, and so I'm here in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, right now, and so that's kind of my experience.
You spoke a minute ago about selective leadership. Could you go into that? What does that mean?
Well, one of the issues that we have is that. Whenever there's a competition for the leadership of the black community, the choice is not made between who is the best leader, but rather the choice is between, of the leaders, which one is the most acceptable to white people. And in particular, not just white people, but our enemies among white people. Because, see, there are white people that, you know, there are white people who are racist. There are white people who are anti-racist. And there are white people who are sort of in between. But we tend to select our leaders based upon who the racist white people will find acceptable. And that means then that if our position is that we want a dollar and the racist position is that they want to give us zero, then instead of us coming to the table and asking for a dollar and then negotiating and then maybe ending up with 50 cents or maybe ending up with a quarter or whatever, we end up, because we do all this negotiation before anything gets started, we start off asking for a quarter. Mm-hmm. And that's because the leadership that we have is the one that, you know, of the people that's going to be picked is, well, you know, we know white folks ain't going to listen to him, you know, so.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know,
so what we got to do is we got to fix that. In fact, we see right now this Loretta Lynch thing. This whole, in fact, I just before you called, I'm reading about Bill Clinton's pollsters in the '90s, Greenberg. He did some research about, you know, well, everybody's talking about what's going to happen in 2022 and whatnot. And he was talking about, you know, how it is that the Democrats have basically lost their mojo with working people, black and white, around the country. And, you know, I forgot where I was going with that because I'm trying to set up the context in which I was saying it. But basically the thing about Loretta Lynch is the idea that, you know, that's an example of somebody who is selected for some reasons other than her love for black people, because there's no way that she'd be representing the owners of the NFL under these circumstances if she had love for black people. So something else got to be motivating her.
You know, that's one of the things that I think we all will have to deal with going forward. How do you deal with that? How do we deal with people who are gatekeepers, as I would call them, gatekeepers? Those people who will only open the gate for certain people to come through. Those people who, once they achieve a certain status, you know, they don't do the, you know, reach back and help. They keep the gate closed, and they only open that gate, as you said, to people who are acceptable or, you know, acceptance to white folk, white people that white folk would like. How do we deal with that going forward?
Right. Well, one of the things is that, you know, one of the problems that we have with our leadership is that they tend to be on an island. In other words, we might, for example, vote for them, but every other input they have intellectually, financially, and otherwise comes from other people. And so as a result, it's very easy for them to sort of lose their bearing. And so one of the things is for us to understand that and to understand that that we have to compete to maintain the loyalty. It's sort of like the same way that you would do if, for example, you had your woman and she was going around other men. You knew you'd have to do some stuff to inoculate her from the impact of those other men. Well, right. That's the same thing we have to do. We have to recognize there are other communities, not just our enemies, but even our allies have their own interests, which may not, you know, be exactly ours. For example, we're concerned about voting, and we're concerned about, you know, police murdering us and so on. And there are other people concerned about, you know, their economics, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whereas we're saying, you know, we already know about driving while black. And so unless we do something about, you know, our ability to exist in this society, it really don't matter how much money we got in our pocket. And so that's our responsibility. But one of the problems that we've had is that, you know, in fact, Jesse Jackson was really good about that when he said, you know, he said that the game in the past had been, he called it client politics, where, you know, where our job was to sort of stand outside the room and pass a note to somebody who was at the table, right? And that, you know, that there needs to be a new vision. And the vision was where we were going to be at the table. But then once we get to the table, then you get Gus Savage, who talked about having power but not using it, or not knowing how to use it, or not knowing what's the purpose of using it, you know, and all that. So there's some work we got to do. It ain't, you know, in other words, it's more than a notion if you want to be free, that you got to do some work to do that. So.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question. As you see it, as you know it, what is critical race theory?
Well, critical race theory is, and this really kind of shows one of the problems that we have, that Martin Luther King defeated Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. But the problem was that Jim Crow was, and the proof, by the way, I talked with someone recently. I said, well, he couldn't have been defeated because, you know, we still got the problem. Well, I mean, you know, Joe Frazier defeated Muhammad Ali in the first fight, but then he didn't defeat him in the second fight. So
that's
just because somebody defeated you don't mean that you didn't kill him. You know, you didn't knock him. You know, they weren't knocked out permanently. Well, so the problem was is that when Martin Luther King defeated white supremacy, you notice at the end, he told Harry Belafonte, he said, well, you know what? I'm afraid we've been integrating into a burning house.
That's right.
That's the very thing that we're seeking to do. It turns out that if we did that, it's not going to achieve our goals. That that America needs an actual transformation of the values of the society itself. And so so that's what critical race theory is. It's that next level. The level that Martin Luther King was the ideal of dealing with racist white people, you know, who hated black people, what they call personal racism, right? Whereas what critical race theory talks about is, hold it now, there are structures in place that are independent of whether somebody likes you or not. In fact, if you remember Stokely Carmichael or Kwame Ture in his book Black Power, where he says that, or you can even get, you get the same sentiment from Carter G. Woodson in the Miseducation of the Negro, where Stokely Carmichael said that, well, you know, the way black power, I mean, the way that racism works is that you can put a black person in the job, and he's going to make the same decision as a white person would make. And it's going to be antithetical to the interests of blacks because that's what the system is designed to do. And so what structural racism does is it addresses that. Now, what has happened is that structural racism is not explicitly taught in the high schools and in the grade schools, not explicitly, but it is implicitly. And one of the problems that we have, and this gets back to this question of leadership, one of the problems that we have is when we got guys that won't fight for us. Like, for example, you saw McAuliffe in Virginia going up against Youngkin, and and they throwing Toni Morrison under the bus. Right?
Yeah.
And the Democrats wouldn't fight because they trying to stay as far away from race or anything related to that as possible, right? It's just all about economics and so on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so that's what it is that our challenge is that our challenge is the Martin Luther King challenge. We have to transform the values of this society. And you know, as a man of the cloth, you know, in the beginning was the word. So if you want to transform the values of a society, you have to start off with what those values are. And that's what you need to address. But the problem that we have is that we've got Democrats who have a sort of materialist understanding, and they're trying to stay as far away from those spiritual questions as possible.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. That brings me to the fact that this transformation we speak about that you're talking about, that has to start at the very core. Am I correct? Because the country started off like that. So this transformation has to be something that has to be torn down and rebuilt. Am I right?
Well, I see it. I see it differently. If you look at the way this country was founded, what happened was that the people who founded the country, in order to they were concerned that if you come over here, and in other words, the Europeans were gangsters, that they were basically, you know, taking things from each other and whatnot. And so they were concerned with protecting, that they were going to steal from the Indians, but they wanted to protect what they stole. And they also wanted to build a big empire once they got over here to America. So in order to do that, they needed to invite poor Europeans over here to work and so on, right? Well, the problem was that they began to be afraid. Now, I'm talking about Gerald Horn here now in his book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, where they were concerned that here you got a country where, you know, I think the profits were like 17,000% on slavery. In other words, you put in a dollar, you get $1,700. I mean, that kind of profit, right?
Right.
And so they were concerned that they were getting ready to lose their good thing. And so that's when they started all this talk about taxation without representation and all that, whereas what was really going on is that they decided that they didn't want to run the risk of anything being done with slavery. But in order for them to fight against slavery, here you got a handful of plantation owners. Well, they're not enough to fight against the British Army, you know, three or four most powerful armies in the world at the time. So they certainly, the only way they could hope to defeat the British was if they had the help of the little people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's when, instead of them saying that this is a beast between, you know, the wealthy, you know, the wealthy in America versus the wealthy in England, they try to make it like it's the beef between the people of America versus the king of England. And so as a result, the first fight that was had in America was the fight for home rule, right? In other words, that we wanted to be able to make decisions in America versus the king of King George. But then the second fight in America, and it began with Shays' Rebellion. Now, if you remember Shays' Rebellion, these were white people who had fought in the Revolutionary War, and they had left their farms and whatnot to fight. And they were paid when company script. And they get back to their farms, and their farms had foreclosure notices on them. And so they all go down to the courthouses in, say, Boston, because Shays was in Massachusetts. They go down to the courthouse in Boston, and they try and explain to the people that the reason they haven't paid, you know, their taxes on their farm is because they've been out fighting the war, and that here's a receipt that shows that the government is going to pay them, and when the government pays them, you know, they'll get paid.
Mm-hmm.
And the people at the desk said, no, we're not accepting no paper. You're going to have to give us some coin. And if you can't give us some coin, we're taking your property, right?
Right.
You know, now Colonel Shays, he was outraged by this, and he had there were a whole lot of other people just like him, right, who had been fighting this war and didn't have nothing coming, right? And so that started the rebellion, right? Now, this is after they had won the war, right?
Right.
Now,
right.
So what ended up happening is in 1867, they realized that, excuse me, I said 1887, they realized that, that is, the wealthy people in America realized, because remember, the first fight was for home rule, and they had already won
right.
that. They had defeated right. George, and so now
right.
the rule was going to be at home. Now, they had talked all that, all men are created equal, and it was this is a democracy. They had talked all that talk when they were fighting against George, but they didn't really mean that. You know, they
okay.
meant that, in fact, John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, said the people who own the country should run the country. And remember, when this country started, the only people who could vote was people who had property. And you didn't just
That's
have
right.
to have something. You had to have some big keys, right? So,
That's right.
So what they did is they decided, well, look, we're going to have these periodic rebellions, not just from the people who we've enslaved and not just from the Indians, but we're also going to have these periodic rebellions from white people. In other words, the white people who ain't got nothing, right, who we brought
mm-hmm.
over here, right? Because
mm-hmm.
they not, because after they little seven-year indenture or however long they're going to be for indenture, they ain't got nothing coming. In fact, if you remember before Shays' Rebellion, there was Bacon's Rebellion. Of white
oh, I'm not familiar
who
with
at
that
the
one.
End of indenture
with
got
that
with
one.
Black people, you know.
Right.
You know, sorry. So let me just narrow this out. So you were asking the question about starting from the beginning. And so what I'm saying then is that, so what they did was that the whole Constitution was designed, because remember, when this started, these were Articles of Confederation, that
right.
it wasn't a United States. States of America, it was a bunch of separate states, right? And but what they were afraid was that they wouldn't have the muscle to be able to subdue their local populations. And so what they wanted was an agreement where if I got a problem with my people in Massachusetts, you'll send your troops to help me put them down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what the Constitution was all about, is they were coming up with an agreement among them, you know, to support each other. But
mm-hmm.
the problem is that it was fairly odd, because remember now, the Constitution was discussed in secret. The people didn't know nothing about it, right? And
That's
the other
right. uh-huh.
thing is that after it was done, they realized that they said, damn, all this shit that we've been talking about democracy and whatnot, and we done come up with this Constitution, and ain't nothing in there about the people. And so they tacked on at the end of that something called the Bill of Rights. Right. In other words, that's for you. Right?
Mm-hmm,
but the stuff
mm-hmm.
for us, that's in the Constitution.
Wow.
So what I'm saying then is that in the beginning, there's always been this tension. And in fact, Barack Obama's second inaugural address, where he talked about, you know, the Constitution and whatnot. So in the beginning, there's been this fundamental tension of whether or not we're going to go with Thomas Jefferson and all men are created equal, and whether we're going to try to build a democracy, or whether we're going to try to build an empire. And that's been a tension. And in fact, if you go and you look at, I forget the senator's name, but he was talking in the 1850s. And by the way, this was a time before black people could vote. This was a time when one of the people was talking even before that. This was even before white people could vote who didn't have property. Now, I'm getting this screwed up, because Andrew Jackson helped white people. White males who didn't have property could vote after Andrew Jackson, and I believe that was like 1828. So this debate
mm-hmm.
had to be happening before then. And the argument was that this was a senator, and he was basically saying, well, yeah, well, you know, we know that y'all, you know, it says all men are created equal and all that, but y'all know we didn't really plan to have no country based on that. That was
mm-hmm.
just pillow talk, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
so that was the intention. So from the beginning, there's always been this idea that the people themselves thought they were coming over here to be a democracy. On the other hand, the people who were running the country said, no, we're just bringing you over here to pimp you the same way we was pimping you back in Europe, right?
Right, right.
That's
right,
what you were
right.
back in Europe, and I don't know why you thought you had something else coming when you got over here. So what I'm saying then is that it doesn't need to be redesigned. In fact, if you look at Barack Obama's second inaugural address, where he asked the question, he asked four questions in his address. And by the way, the only thing Barack did is he had some good game. I mean, he has some, you know, some slick words. All his action was anti-democratic. In fact, he's the reason that Trump won, you know, in 2016. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. but his rhetoric, though, were solid, because what he said is that he said, well, first of all, what makes us American? And he said, are we American because we white, because we Christian, because we came from Europe, or are we American because we agree in the American creed? And he said, no, it's because we agree with the American creed. So that was the first question. That's the thing mm-hmm. as a physical, a logical, a social, and a spiritual dimension. So the second mm-hmm. dimension of his essay goes to the logical question. Well, if the basis for us being America is this American creed, then the logical question is, well, how does this creed work? And he says there are two possibilities. Either this creed is like a tablet that Moses had, something written in concrete that, you know, mm-hmm. you just have to, you know, sit there and read and weep, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Or is this a living document that needs to be interpreted with each generation? And he said, well, it's a living document that needs to be interpreted with each generation,
mm-hmm.
right? Then you get to the social dimension. And so he asked the question, well, okay, if it's a document that needs to be interpreted, well, then who does the interpretation, right? And then that's where he quotes Lincoln. He says, well, you know, we fought a civil war for a country of, by, and for the people. So it seemed to me that the people need to decide how to interpret, you know, the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
right? So that
mm-hmm.
was the third dimension. And then the fourth dimension is the spiritual. It says, well, okay, if the people are supporting or interpreting this Constitution or this American creed, well, what is the aim? What are they interpreting? What are they interpreting it to do, right? And he says, well, you know, well, obviously, you know, we fought the war to end slavery and all that. We don't want that. And so what we want is liberty and justice, you know, for everybody, right? So, I mean, his rhetorics could not be assailed. There's nobody who can possibly say anything more appropriate than what Barack said, but his actions were like the exact opposite of that. But nevertheless, in other words, so we got some licks that we can hit, but we gotta work.
Well, you've answered that question well. I agree with you on the transformation concept, and I think that many of us did not realize at the time, especially when we studied American history, that that was a game. It was a game that America was playing on King George. We like you say, they really never had any intention of forming a country as they had written. We're going to take a few minutes, let Brother Pugh get a sip of water, and then we're going to come back and talk about some other things that he's involved in. And we'll also ask him, I'm going to ask him, what are some of the books that that people can read, people who are just getting into history, just understanding about our people. What are some of the books that we can pick up and read that will inspire us to come? Let's take about 2 minutes, and we'll be right back.
Yeah.
talking with Brother James Pugh, a lifelong historian, a man who has studied, a man who has some very strong opinions and are able to back them up with facts. And I am so glad that he is with us tonight. Brother Pugh, I notice you are one of the regular contributors to the Black Reality Think Tank that can be heard on Tuesday night at 8 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Central on the Time for Awakening program. And I noticed that many of you, the guests and the speakers and the callers that call in on that program, you all give out resources. You always talk about books that you have read and where you got a lot of your knowledge. What are some of the books that, now, I'm not a, let's just say I'm someone who doesn't read. I haven't been to a library. I encourage everyone to get a library card or find a place where you can find books or a bookstore or somewhere where you can get information. But Brother Pugh, what are some of the books that we can pick up or some of the books that people can buy that are easy reading but yet they're informative?
Well, actually, I think they will love my answer. It turns out that everything is connected to everything. If you look at people who do forecasting, they recognize that to predict what's going to happen in the world, you need to understand the political, the economic, the social, and the technical forces that are operating in society. So that means you have to read widely if you want to understand anything. In fact, that's the distinction between knowledge and wisdom, is that knowledge is narrow, but wisdom is broad and it's wide and it's deep. And so I would say that, you know, there are two go-to guys, not two books, but two go-to guys, two long-distance runners. One is an 82-year-old, he was a former dean at San Francisco, Dean of African American Studies at San Francisco State University. His name is Oba Tshaka, T-apostrophe-S-H-A-K-A. He's the best man I done ever heard of, period. He's the, I tell people, he's the baddest in I know. Oba Tshaka, he's got a program on YouTube every Saturday. And he references all kind of sources and materials and whatnot, in addition to giving you an update commentary on what's going on in the world today, and giving you some background, because he was on the front line. In fact, this was a man that walked with Malcolm X, walked with Martin Luther King, right? So this man was on the front line in the 1960s, and he on the front line now. So he's a go-to guy. And there's another fellow who was equally renowned. His name is Dr. Greg Carr. He's a historian, and he teaches in the law school at Howard University. And he also has a program that's on YouTube, and he has some other ways that you can access him. He also has reading clubs where they're reading. I believe they're reading W.E.B. Du Bois, of the Souls of Black Folk right now.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way,
oh, yeah,
they're not lecturing. It's that, you know, I think he's got about 1,300 people, and they're reading, and, you know, and each of them, you know, saying, you know, what they think they're saying. And so those are some good resources, because I'm really not interested in intellectuals who just trying to get some credentials and go to a group and brag about what they read. No, I'm interested in changing the world, and that's what these fellows are interested in.
Yeah. I agree with you. The Soul of Black People, I have that on my desk. I keep it on my desk all the time. And I always go back and look at it from time to time. And I've probably had it for probably about 25 years. And it's just one of those, go-to books, one of those books you just go-to. Also, one of my favorite is The Message to the Black Man by Honorable Elijah Muhammad. A lot of people have never read that book, but I'm telling you, I got great wisdom out of that book. And I'm not a Muslim, I'm a Christian, but I found great wisdom in that book. And there are a lot of books that that people can pick up. You called out Carter G. Woodson's Miseducation of the Negro. I think that's a good book where people can start as well, because, you know, I guess Brother P, in order to educate ourselves, we have to kind of de-educate ourselves. Is that the right term?
Well, in fact, I remember Naeem Akbar, when I was going to school, that, you know, he talked about how we need to have a Saturday school. That he said, yeah, they filling our heads with nonsense during the week. And so we have to, you know, at the end of the week, we have to have some kind of way, you know, to recover from that. I think another book, if you just want to name a book, that kind of two books I can just mention. But by the way, as I say, Obata Shaka and Dr. Carr, they're the ones, because they're going to be mentioning all kinds of books. They're always going to be relevant to what's going on now and whatnot. But two books that just, you know, kind of general. I think that to understand the problem that we have today, getting the crisis of the Negro intellectual is useful, because mm-hmm. what it talks about is this ideal of a people who are not doing the work, who are simply piggybacking on the intellectual outputs from other communities and thinking that we can simply do what they're doing and that it's going to get us over. And so that's what the crisis of the Negro intellectual talks about, is that, hey, there's some Negro intellectuals that ain't got no ideas, that they ain't put in the work, right? And then the next book is Stamped from the Beginning. You talked about critical race theory, and that's one of the foundation work. Well, that's not really a foundation work, but certainly he's one of the people who are on the front line being attacked for critical race theory. And he sort of gives you, you know, generally the way that people understand history, they get this thin description of history where, you know, there's these good guys and these bad guys and whatnot. He takes you to the founding of this country. I believe he starts in about, you know, 1650 or whenever, you know, he starts, you know, whenever, 1500 or whenever. In fact, he even goes beyond before that, because he even talks about Africa and some of the kind of racist things that were done there before we even got here. But the key thing that he does that I think people are going to find useful is that he has a continuous conversation between what he calls the racist, the anti-racist, and the there's sort of like there's a neutral group. I'll describe them. If you're racist, you believe that black people are inherently inferior and can't nothing be done about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
That would be a Donald Trump, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you're there was some other word he had where you weren't a straight-up racist where we're inherently inferior. You like a Barack Obama type. You're a racist.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you believe black people are inferior, but you believe with the right education and the right access to white people, we can be brought up to speed. Right? And then there's a third group of people called the anti-racists. And that means, mm-hmm. no, black people are whole people. They're complete. They're entire. They have all the things they need to do to function in the world. In fact, they got some stuff that they can even tell white people about how to be humans on this planet, right? And so what Ibram Kendi in Stamped from the Beginning, what he does is he traces the thread of people who thought racially, anti-racially, and then I forget what that middle category is, but, you know, kind of, I think he called the racists, I think he would say they were segregationists, whereas the middle category, he would call them integrationists. And then the third category, the one that says these are a whole people that need their own space and whatnot, I forget the word he would have for them. But you might, you know, if you just want a book, you know, that's another
mm-hmm.
book that I think is
mm-hmm.
lit.
Mm-hmm.
that's good. You know, Brother P, we have so many things to deal with. We have voting rights. We have these police shootings of our young people. We have trouble in our schools. We have trouble in our homes, our marriages not coming together well. We're not raising our children the way we should. Where are we now? What should we be doing now as a people so that the next generation will be better or fare better than we did?
Well, one of the things that you have to do is you have to recognize, you have to think strategically, right? And you have to recognize that we've got a lot of problems and we've got finite resources and our problems are interconnected with each other. And then, you know, we have to, you know, address them, you know, at pace. That's why I say that the fundamental problem that we have right now, in fact, let me put it this way. there are people who talk about our economic problems, right? They talk about if, you know, the problem with between a man and a woman is because of money, and so if they had mm-hmm. money, that wouldn't be and whatnot. But mm-hmm. we know that there's something called driving while black, that
right.
some of the problems that we have today are not because we don't have resources. It's because we have resources and other people, you know, feel like, you know, we shouldn't have them, that we're out of place. And so more important than economic wherewithal is political wherewithal. And so the first thing that we, you know, our number one priority is to establish our right to exist as human beings. Now, the problem that we had in the past, the whole black respectability politics was all about establishing our right to exist because we're just like white people. That's what Martin Luther King was saying. But what white people were saying was that, yeah, that's what we're afraid of. We're afraid that you're just like us, and we know how we get down. So if
mm-hmm.
you're just like us, then if we let up on you, we're going to have some problems out of you, right?
Right,
and so that's
right.
why they've been promoting people like Snoop Dogg and the NFL, in other words, showing this thug life and these gangsters. Because if you remember, William Styron, the writer, after Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, where this black preacher is getting up and telling these white people that he just wants to be judged by the content of his character and whatnot, William Styron said he was afraid. In fact, he says this. He says, I was afraid that white people were going to buy that. And so he went out and he wrote a book called The Confessions of Nat Turner. And in
mm-hmm.
The Confessions of Nat Turner, that's the story about a preacher. Martin Luther King was a preacher
mm-hmm.
who was talking all that God stuff, but he killed white people, even white babies, right? So in other words, don't trust Martin Luther King. He'll kill you, right? And so one of the things they're doing with Snoop and them is this ideal of any of y'all that think that black people are these meek and nice people and humble and that, you know, they just want to go along and get along. Well, you know, if you show me a few of these thug videos and whatnot, then you'll say, nah, these are thugs. Right. And
mm-hmm.
so that's the intent. Right. Is that they feel like Martin Luther King beat us because he made the world look at us as beasts and black people as noble. What
mm-hmm.
we want to do is we want to muddy black people up some. We want to have them themselves. In other words, we already know that when we said they were inferior, everybody said, nah, that was just racist white people saying they're inferior. So we want it coming out their mouth. So all right, here's Snoop, here your shot. You know, you get
right.
on the Super Bowl and get in a prison uniform and dance, right? Because that's what y'all
wow.
gonna be doing. Y'all gonna be dancing while y'all in prison.
Wow.
So what do you think history will say about us? How do you think 50 years from now, 100 years from now, how do you think we'll be written in history? What do you think? Because I agree with you what you just said. I think that'll probably be a part of it as well.
Well, one of the things is that, you know, there's a wisdom in the people, but I've always said that what has happened with us is that they've gone out of their way to essentially make sure that the people's voice is not involved. By the way, it's the same with white people. You
mm-hmm.
find 90% of white people want something to be done about guns. Ain't nothing being done about guns, right? Because,
mm-hmm.
in other words, if you want to produce one of these civilizations or whatever they want to call it, you can't afford to be listening to the wisdom of the people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you need to be listening to the few people who are pimps like you, right, who know
mm-hmm.
how to put the pimping down. That's who you need to be listening to. You don't need to be listening to somebody talking about right makes might. You want to be listening to somebody telling you might makes right, you know,
mm-hmm.
and so on,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that's the problem, that our people haven't had a voice.
Okay.
And increasingly, they're beginning to have a voice. And that's one of the reasons that, in fact, now you remember how the game goes. It says that as soon as black people learn the game, you need to change the rules of the game, right?
That's right.
So what had happened is they had been, you know, playing the game with us and, you know, about voting and all that and, you know, 100% of white people, you know, senators and stuff, voting for the Voting Rights Act and all that kind of stuff. We messed around and figured out how to get Barack Obama elected president. They said, what?
Mm-hmm.
They done figured out how to play this game. They immediately changed the game. immediately with the quickness, right? And so that's what's been going on, is that our people, that is the people, haven't been participating, and the people who have been participating are the ones selected by whites. And so it's like you playing a football game, and the coach of your team is coached by the other team. They know all the plays and all who your personnel are going to be. you know, they know. In fact, it sickens me when I listen to, you know, these kind of intensive debates with black people. I remember, I can't think of any recently, but I remember in the mid-90s, I'm listening to these people debating some stuff in about 1995, some stuff that had been resolved in 67, right?
Wow.
In other words, they just, you know, just, I mean, I just felt like, you know, what are y'all, you know, it's like, you know. So one of the problems that we have is that we haven't been, as a people, we haven't been in the game. And in fact,
right.
That was one of the reasons that I thank you for your recognition of me, because strategically, the problem that we have right now is there's a wisdom in our elders. But our elders are on the bench. They've been played out of pocket. They've been told the only thing that's valuable is they back. And now that they back ain't strong, they need to get out the pasture somewhere because they ain't got nothing else to do, right? Whereas the reality is, yeah, you may not be able to do the crossover and the slam dunk and all that, but you can be a coach.
That's right.
A conditioning trainer. There's all kind of stuff you can do, right? And
exactly.
The stuff you can do is needed, right? And so one of the things is that we got to do is that, in fact, when I hear these people talking about they're going to save the children, that the whole ideal is somehow or another, because what they mean when they say they're going to save the children, they mean they're going to throw away the adults, right? That means they're going to throw away the elders, right? We don't need
okay.
none of that.
Wow.
We just need a
okay.
fresh crop of children that we can put the pimping down on, right?
Wow.
Whereas the reality is, no, we need our elders to get in the game. Because let me just hit this one lick. If the only thing you've ever done in your life, it turns out that everything is related to everything else. And it turns out that while you was digging ditches, there was some licks that you were hitting that Einstein would have hit with his differential geometry, that Ramanujan would have hit with his Mach theta mathematics function. So what I'm saying, in fact, one of the things that I was just looking at something on this recently, where this fellow was talking about the mathematician Ramanujan. This was an Indian, poor Indian mathematician who was self-trained and whatnot. And this was before World War I. And he wrote down some equations and stuff, and people just couldn't believe that, you know, he knew these. First of all, they didn't know him and couldn't wonder where did he get them from and whatnot. Any case, they found out this fellow was absolutely brilliant, and, you know, cell phones and all kind of things that are being done today are based on this fellow's ideas. But I was listening to something just the other day, and one of the fellows discussing this, he said, you know, I was at a meeting with the SETI Foundation, you know, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, they were talking about how they were going to have some satellites going up trying to see if there's some extra intelligence in Alpha Centauri or some other planet somewhere, right? And he said that he mentioned to them, he said, well, you know, it's ironic that y'all are spending all of these resources to find out if there's intelligence on other planets and ignoring the intelligence right here, right?
Right,
like,
here on this
like
planet.
This fellow Ramanujan, right? And so since then, you know, they've identified any number of people, you know, who are brilliant. But once again, it's only within their little narrow technological, you know, BS that they're doing. But nevertheless, the same way that there are those resources available, there's wisdom in us, in every one of us, right? But you know, it's sort of like you know, what the man said, who you gonna believe, me or your lying eyes, right? If I convince you, what did Carter G. Woodson say? If I convince you that you inferior and whatnot, I don't have to tell you to go in the back door. You'll make a back door.
Because
you're not going to be comfortable coming in the front. And that's the problem
exactly.
that we have right now. We got these people talking about how smart they are because they got a grade in school, or they don't know something because they didn't, you know, read a book. I mean, please. You know. So. In fact, let me just hit one more lick on this.
Go right in.
You know, one day I'm reading some deep mathematics, And a friend of mine, you know, this was on a Friday. He said, hey, man, you know, why don't you come and meet me down at this club, right? And I said, because you know, it's a new club in town. This was years ago when I was in the game. And so I said, okay. So I go down there to the club, but I still got my mind on this mathematics that I was reading before I was there. And I'm watching this girl dance, and I'm looking at one. She's listening to the music. She's in rhythm with what her body is doing, plus she's in rhythm with what other people are doing, plus she's adding style. And then I'm comparing that with what I had to do to be doing the mathematics. And I'm saying, look, this little mathematics I'm doing, this stuff is standing still. Right? In other words, mm-hmm. whatever I come up with, I ain't got to worry about it being in another place when I come back. It's going to be in the same spot, right? Whereas mm-hmm. what she's doing is changing in real time, right? This is way mm-hmm. more difficult than what I'm doing, right? And so mm-hmm. what happens is that, unfortunately, we tend to look at the world through our enemy's eyes as opposed to our own, and as a result, we devalue what it is that we do. So what do they say? A fool and their wealth will soon part. And so that's what happens, is that all the wisdom of the people, you know, it don't get played because we don't think we got it to play.
Well, this conversation has been enlightening. We have about 3 minutes left. Is there something that we have not talked about tonight that you would like to bring up, or something that you would like to leave us with?
Let me see. Is there any lick that I can hit that I haven't hit? Let me see. Let me see here.
Well, that's fine. You have given us.
I can't really think of
enough to digest. It's going to take us a couple of days to digest all that you have given us. And I thank you so very much for coming on and being so eloquent and being able to explain things in a layman term, so that we all can understand, to make it plain as we see it, to make it plain. And I thank you so very much.
Well, I certainly tried. But you know, your questions were beautiful, man. I thought, yeah, that you were sort of putting it right over the plate.
Well, thank God for that.
You know, right. In other words, you wasn't no hiding inside, wasn't none of that kind of stuff, you know.
But truly, I truly thank you for being a part of this segment tonight. We will be playing this over and over again during the course of the Gospel Gold season. I will be posting this segment with Brother Pugh throughout the year, and you will be able to go to the Gospel Gold group's Facebook page, and you will find this particular segment in Black History. History Speaks Part 2. You will be able to find that on the Gospel Gold Facebook page. I thank you again, Brother Pugh, and I thank you so very much, and I pray that you will have a great week. And until we talk again, let's stay together, all right?
Okay, well, thank you, Reverend Rogers, and you've got a good platform. Beautiful.
Thank you so very much, sir. Thank you so very much. And we'll see you on the Black Reality Think Tank.
Okay, all right.
All right, have a good night.
Lift every voice and sing, till earth and heaven ring. Ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise high as the march on till victory.